This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Listening to your podcast has really helped me in letting go of that shame and knowing that I'm not alone. It truly does happen to all people from all different walks of life, all different careers, all socioeconomic statuses, races, like geographical locations, everything.
The When Dating Hurts podcast is rated one of the most popular relationships podcasts in the world. Why is that? It's our guests. Whether you're listening to subject matter experts or domestic violence survivors, you know you're hearing what you need to know, and that is the truth about dating and domestic violence. Why it happens, how it happens, when it happens, where it happens, and how victims become survivors. This podcast is a powerful way for you, your friends, and your family to stay informed and stay safe. Thank you for your support. We resume our conversation with Jamie. By now, she's a lawyer, a prosecutor handling all kinds of serious cases, and yet, her own personal difficulties continue to get the best of her.
It's embarrassing. I was embarrassed by what happened. So I didn't want to call my friend and tell her because it's like, how do you justify that?
This is your boyfriend? Yeah, this is your boyfriend? You call this guy your boyfriend?
And I certainly wasn't going to call my parents and tell them that because, again, I thought this the same thing. They're going to be like, well, absolutely not. Like, you're...
Get out of there. What are you waiting for?
So... You know, I don't remember exactly how it happened. He comes back from the trip, but he was sorry for what happened. It wasn't a big deal what happened.
It was.
In his opinion.
Exactly. It was better to have him come back and it be okay than me push. I was hesitant to push on what happened because I didn't know what that would turn into. But I knew if we made up, like, okay, it's...
And that's a place that I've heard a number of people who are survivors, where they go is they look at it like, you know what? I don't like this. I don't feel it's right. I don't think I did anything wrong. If anything happened that was wrong, he did it. But I'll opt for peace. So let's move on. Does that come close?
Yeah. And again, what was it? He shoved me? Like, what was that? He didn't hit me. Because again, I remember thinking, if he punched me, I would know, okay, that's abuse. But that wasn't this. It was just this, it was a shove. And same thing with the spitting. Like, it felt volatile when it happened. And I had never had anything like that happen before. But I'm like, but he didn't lay a hand on me.
But spitting is for a lot of people. I mean, it's degrading. It's a statement. That's a big statement.
Yeah. You know, he came back and we, what about the summer? The school year starts. Very busy. And again, nothing happens. Nothing to that level happens for a very long time. We're going about the school year. We're seeing his family. We're talking about our plans for the future. You know, I remember, and you start studying for the bar, like towards the end of your like 3L year. You know, I remember going to his family's house one time. His mother had been drinking. He was very upset about how much she had been drinking. He had also been drinking at the time. You know, I don't remember exactly, or I didn't see exactly what happened, but he got upset and he left his house and he like went down the street or something. And his brother and his father followed him. And then he leaves, like he drives and he leaves. And his brother and dad come back in and his dad is upset, crying. And I come to learn he hit his father.
Oh, while they were outside, he hit his father?
Yeah. And
gee, that's big.
Yeah. And I bring that up because it is big. And, at, you know, I mean, it was at the time, but I think, again, after the fact, you try to rationalize it or minimize it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But it was like, wow, what could have happened? Or what is in this history of this family that I don't know? That, like, that's what you did. And I remember his sister drove me to his apartment because we were concerned about him. We went in and we're trying to talk to him, and he kind of shoved me away. Like, he was in his bed and he kind of shoved me away. And I remember saying, you said you were never going to do that again. Like, I'm not doing this. Like, we're leaving. And we went back to his parents' house, and, you know, his father was so upset and was asking me if I was okay and told me that I could stay there. And just this whole, so you go to sleep, you wake up the next morning, and again, it's like, what happened?
What a scene. What a scene. What drama.
I cared about his family. They seemed like good people. I think they were good people, but nothing was, you know, at least I was never involved in any kind of conversation that happened with his family after the fact. I don't know what came of that, what they said or anything. You know, I just know that the next day, like, he was upset about what happened, said it wouldn't happen again. And we just went about our business of going to class and studying and all that. And as the year went on, I knew I wanted to be a prosecutor. Obviously, your last year of law school, the big thing is finding a job, going on interviews and all of that. You know, it was hard where we were to get a job at a prosecutor's office because they were smaller offices. So I made a decision. I was going to apply to major cities because they'd be hiring more people. And that's what I was going to be doing. And he went to law school to make money. That's what he wanted to do. And he thought he had a very clear thing of what he thought, you know, success meant. And that meant, you know, going to the city, making a lot of money, being quote unquote successful.
Would that be as a defense lawyer? What would that be? What did he have in mind?
Actually, tax law. So I don't know if he ever ended up really practicing law. I don't know what he did, but he was, you know, in the financial side of things. You know, we finish our 3L year.
And now you're graduated, right? From law school.
Graduated. Yep. And
you have to take the bar, don't you, and things?
Take the bar. So we took the bar in separate states. That's anxiety producing.
Did you head back to Pennsylvania? Where'd you go?
I did. So I went back to Pennsylvania. Started a job that August after law school. The way it works is you start the job, but you're not even a barred attorney yet. So if you don't pass the bar, you lose your job. So there's a lot of pressure.
Imagine so.
When I moved to where I moved to, again, I felt alone. I was in a new place. My family was not there. They were still some distance away. He was in another state. And here I am again with 25 other best of the best, if you will, people who went to their, you know, went to law school, did well, and now here they are. So it's this competitiveness that was present. I had a lot of anxiety. Just with everything, it was a lot. Again, looking back now, I start to see how it became more and more about what he wanted and less about what I had wanted. He, I think, definitely thought that at some point I would move to where he was. And, you know, why couldn't I get a job at any prosecutor's office? That kind of thing. I remember when I got sworn in, my parents came, and, you know, it's a big deal, and other people's family come, and he didn't come. It was during the work week, and he couldn't come. And I just feel like it was that start of that, really, my career didn't matter as much as his and his priorities.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So we did the long distance thing for a while and going back and forth. I definitely saw it was becoming more of, well, why wouldn't you come to, he was in New York. So New York is
not that far away.
Not that far away. And in his opinion is
hour and a half by train, right? Yeah. An hour and a half.
And in his opinion, it was like the end all be all. And I love New York, nothing against New York. But in his, you know, in his opinion, Philadelphia was not as, where I was not as important in the role of things or grand scheme of things.
Your little job in Philadelphia as a prosecutor. Yeah.
Yeah.
At this point in time, you passed the bar and you're working, aren't you?
Yes. So I'm working full time, and full time was...
You got the job. You're doing it. And I would imagine they pay you for 5 days a week and you work six or seven. Did that come close?
Yeah, I was going to say like 8 or 9 days a week. So this job was, you know, big deal for me. This is, a lot of people go to law school and don't know what they wanted to do. Like, I went and I knew what I wanted to do. They're interviewing people from all over the place. I can't tell you how many applicants there were, and I got it. And most people didn't have a job when they graduated. Like, I was very fortunate. This was, you know, a big deal. So when I was doing that, I was working, it was ridiculous, getting in at 8 o'clock, leaving at 10 o'clock at night, at least 4 out of the 5 weekdays. And then you're bringing work home with you on the weekends, or you're going in on the weekend, because the learning curve was so high and steep. You just, and the volume of cases was, you know.
And let me interject, just from prosecutors I've met over time, when you look at what's at stake, some gaffe along the way, some mistake, something overlooked, and it's very possible that somebody who committed a heinous crime will walk. So that's a big deal.
I certainly felt, and still do feel, a very big responsibility to people. So we are, you know, I'm doing that, he's doing his job, and it's more and more of me going there. I'm going there a little more than he's coming to me, that kind of dynamic. My first year, that happened. And again, I don't remember anything happened. And that was significant for me because I always said those were like one-offs. Like, what happened wasn't right, but like, he was drinking. And then like, what happened again, wasn't right, but like, what was that even? And there were long periods of time where nothing happened. So I would say it wasn't until I finished like my first year of working there and doing that. You know, I remember things though. I remember like one time we had a disagreement and he tried to take my phone. And this is when he was in Philadelphia. At the time, we didn't have a landline. I lived alone. I didn't have a lot of friends. I was still, you know, I worked so much, and then people would socialize after work and on the weekends. But I wasn't doing that because I was going to New York to be with him. So that was something like that kind of isolation.
You say he took your phone. What was that supposed to accomplish, do you think?
I mean, he was going to take my phone and leave with it, in his mind anyway. He gave me that phone for like Christmas or something. So he thought, I gave this to you, I'm going to take it back. But that was my lifeline.
It's not just an electronic instrument. It is a lifeline in a lot of different directions.
I don't know what happened. He didn't take it. But that, you know, becomes significant down the road. But I'm doing my job and he was making money and wanted to travel. And I didn't, I was like, I can't take off time from work. You know, I just started this job. I can't do that. I'm a public servant. I'm not making money to do that. But he wanted to travel. That was something important for him. And I remember we went on a trip to California. You know, I remember being out there. And again, we got in a fight. I remember him driving on these roads, like we ended up getting lost or something. And this is now 15 years ago or something. Like, we didn't have GPS and your smartphones and all that stuff. So like, we ended up getting sort of lost, and he was very angry by that. And I remember, again, him driving aggressively and like speeding, and I wanted to get out of the car. And I was like, what am I going to do though? I don't even know where I am. What am I going to do? Call someone and make this? I think that was part of it too. I was like, am I going to make this bigger than it needs to be? We get back from the trip. We decided to like go have a picnic in the park. We were in Philadelphia. You know, we had like a bottle of wine and we're like having lunch and like nothing crazy. But I bring up the alcohol because I, in my mind, always said, oh, well, he had a couple drinks. So maybe that had something to do with why he acted the way he acted. Or he would say, I was drinking, and that's, you know, you can have as many drinks as you want. If you're not a violent person, you're not going to act that way.
It enhances the bad behavior. It doesn't cause it.
Right. Exactly. So we were at the park and we're talking about getting married, just kind of like casually talking about getting married in the future. And he and I are different religions. I was saying, well, I'd want to get married in my church and he would want to get married in his church. And I knew that was kind of like a point of contention over the years. But, and then we were talking about when I changed my name, my last name. And I was like, no, I don't think I would. Like, I've been in this job now for a year and a half. Everyone knows me by that name. Like, like I'm establishing myself, so I don't know that I would want to change my name. And he was very angered by that. So we are walking back to my apartment and we're fighting. And I'm just like, this is ridiculous. Like, and we get in the elevator to go up to my apartment. I think he knew my things I struggled with or what I thought were weaknesses. That relationship that I had had from college into law school when we broke up, it impacted me. He knew that. He made a comment like, well, you couldn't even keep him. Something like that. Just, you know, kind of jab. And I said something back to him. I don't remember what it was. And he kicked me.
Oh.
I was standing kind of in front of him. And he must have picked his leg up. And the way I can explain it, like with the sole of his foot, he kicked me in my lower back. He sent me flying into the elevator doors.
Kind of a kick push kind of thing.
Yeah. The elevator opened. Moments after that, I got out. I was like, we're done. Like, get away from me. I opened the door to my apartment. I was like, I would not go in the apartment with him. I was like, get your stuff. That was the first time I ever said, I was like, that was abusive. Like, get out, go. Like, we're done. And he left. And again, I didn't know what to do after the fact. I knew that was wrong. I didn't want to tell anyone. I was ashamed of what happened and I didn't want to tell anyone.
And honestly, in some ways, who would you tell anyway? You got to go running off to all your friends and it's like, wait a minute, this is a guy that you've been dating for years. This is your boyfriend, at least in quotes, and you're processing all these things. And you're thinking like, here, we're talking about getting married. Do I keep the name or not? You know, we're at the point of talking marriage. And then this goes on. What's real after a while?
Exactly. And I wasn't going to tell my parents because I knew if I told them that would be the end of it.
That paints the future. Because if you go and marry him, it's like, you're going to marry the guy that did that. So you don't want to say anything.
The relationships that I was forming were with my colleagues. So it was like, how am I going to tell them that this happened? Because I'm a prosecutor and I handle domestic violence cases in court. I work with victims. How could this happen to me? And I think that definitely played into that. And going back to, you know, what happened to me when I was 18, it was minimized. What I did with this. I broke up with him for a period of time. I don't know. I don't remember how long it was. He would call me. We didn't see each other for weeks. But at some point, we started talking again. And again, he was sorry. He had had a couple drinks. He didn't mean it. It will never happen again.
He backed the truck up with all these things again and showed them to you. You know, that was every one of these is an aberration.
Exactly. And since it happened so far apart.
It's a difference between adding one plus one plus one plus one. These guys like to multiply one times one times one times one times one. You may have had 30 things happen, but one times one 30 times is one. So it's just, you know, it's like, okay, very sorry. Never happened again. I don't know what I was thinking. Probably was a little bit to do with drinking. Why don't you stop talking about it? I'll stop talking about it. Let's move on.
I'm like, you need to get counseling. Like, you have anger management issues. And again, that was my not understanding the domestic violence dynamic and all of that stuff. I was like, oh, it's an anger issue or it's a drinking issue. And it's like, I won't drink. And yes, I'll do that stuff. And that was kind of what got me back into the relationship.
So you're back in again.
We're back in again. And we're still doing the long distance thing. You know, this time in my life was my one grandmother was kind of sick and stuff was going on. And then it was in December of that year, my other grandmother, she passed away. She got sick and went into hospice very quickly. And she was very far away from where I was, probably like 6 or 7 hours away. And I went up there and stuff and I wanted him to come up and he didn't come up. And he just wasn't there for me at all. I was very close to my grandmother when she passed away. That was very upsetting. And this is right before the holidays.
Sure.
You know, then that year we were supposed to do the holidays with his family, which we like never really did before. My other grandmother had kind of been sick. And I remember being like, well, maybe I should go out there. It's only a couple hours away. Like, maybe I should go. And he was like, what? You don't need to do that. I wanted to see her. I should have done it. Mm-hmm. Who cares that it was, you know, 2 or 3 hours away, but he kind of said, you don't need to do that. And then she ended up passing away 5 weeks after my other grandmother passed away.
That's hard. That is so hard.
So I'm in this place again where I'm so distraught about my grandmother's, but I'm like, well, I'm only a year and a half into this job. How much time can I be taking off? I felt very fortunate that I knew my grandmothers, that they were in my life for that amount of time.
I just want to ask you something about your job. How many cases do you think are crossing your desk at any given time? Because I've talked with prosecutors who will say things like, I'm not working on 80 cases, but there are 80, I guess you'd call them live cases that could pop up at any point besides the, let's call it 10 that are hot right now.
Hundreds. So
that's a lot.
Where I worked at that time when you first started there, we would go into court. There would be 60 cases on the list any given day, and I would have 30 of them. And that's not the best way to handle cases. However, that's the reality of the volume of cases that we had and the way that system was set up. So, you know, it was either felony preliminary hearings, which so there was always like another step to it, or misdemeanor trials. Mm-hmm. It changes as you move through the office or in your career, it can change like the amount of cases that you're handling. But I was in a very busy city.
Yes.
And it was a big deal. And you felt like if you didn't show up, then you're putting that on your colleagues. If you took time off, well, then they had to step in. And that's just so much more work on them. So that was a lot. And during this time, he wasn't particularly supportive. You know, I don't even remember if he came to like funerals or things like that, but we were still seeing each other and doing this long distance thing. And then it was February of 2010. He came to Philadelphia and we were going out for my friend's birthday. Everyone's drinking. We were out for a very long time. We ended up going from the party to a different bar. This bar was a very big bar and we ended up getting lost from each other. Not even lost. I went to the restroom or something, and then it took us some time to find each other. And I finally find him, and he's outside with one of my friends, and he's pissed because I left him, which I didn't. I just went to the restroom, and we kind of got lost in the crowd, but he was very angry. It's like, you know what? Okay, let's go home. So we get in a cab. He's just angry the whole way home. We get to my apartment, and I didn't have cash on, and this is before Uber. You could use a card in there, but obviously like the drivers preferred cash because then they didn't have to pay a surcharge or anything like that. So I didn't want to use my card when I knew he had cash. I said, hey, can you, you know, and he was being a jerk about it. And I was like, just give me your wallet. So I took his wallet, paid the driver. We went inside. He's angry. He's leaving. He's packing his stuff. I put his wallet on my dresser and he's like searching for stuff. And he's like, where is my wallet? I can't find my wallet. He's getting kind of enraged about this. And I'm like, I'm not telling him because you're being such a jerk. It's right there, you know? And then I thought to myself, you know what? You better hide your cell phone. Because I knew he was leaving and I thought he might try to take your phone again, like he did that last time.
Right. Sabotage you a little bit. Yeah.
So I put the phone under my bed. This whole thing's going on and he can't find his wallet. He's ticked off. He goes into the other room and I follow him into the other room. And I was like, it's on the dresser. Like, stop acting like a child, like something like that. He gets the wallet off the dresser and then he's about to leave and we're exchanging words and he picks up a vase with flowers in it.
Oh.
Ironically, that he had given me for Valentine's Day, right? And he chucks the thing at me.
Throws it at you.
And this was like a heavy Waterford glass vase.
Oh, brother. That's awful.
Hits the wall. Flowers go everywhere. And he runs up and he, what I would say is like a football player, when they go to tackle someone, they kind of like go down and put their shoulder. That's what he did to me. And he threw me into the wall.
Oh.
And I actually went into the wall, like went through the part of the drywall.
You actually broke the wall, physically broke the wall.
And I, you know, again, you think you're in shock, and I kind of fell down to the ground, and I kind of crawled to, like, get away from him, and, like, he came back over, and I was moving, and I, like, remember I had a plastic chair that I, like, picked up to try to just keep distance between he and I.
Yes.
And he just, like, threw it like it was nothing, like it was...
Right, just brushed it away.
And then he put his hands around my neck and started strangling me. And the very first thought I had was, oh, so this is what it feels like.
Oh, my.
I handled domestic violence cases as a prosecutor. I had dozens of women come on the stand and testify about being strangled. And hearing so many people tell you about it, nothing can articulate what it's really like. Yeah.
Whole different thing.
And I can't breathe. And the very next thought I had was, oh my God, this is how my parents are going to find out I died. And I'm trying to get at him, but he's, you know, has his arms out, kind of locked, his hands around my throat, and I can't breathe, and there's pressure, and I had another smaller vase that was, like, behind me to the left. I just grabbed it, and I smashed him in the face with it, like his eye, and he let go.
Oh.
And I ran to the door and opened the door, and I said, the police are coming. Like, the neighbors called the police, and he grabbed his bag and he left. And that was the last time I ever saw him.
Now, you said the police are coming. Why would you say that? I mean, do you know? You don't know?
I thought he would know.
It was just something you made up on the spot just to let him know that time for you to exit.
Exactly. Like, I lived in an apartment.
You wanted to alarm him as much as you possibly could.
Yeah, I lived in an apartment. I figured,
got to be a lot of noise involved here.
Got to be a lot of noise. Like, he would think maybe, someone did call the cops and he wouldn't want to get.
And you say that's the last time you ever saw him.
Uh-huh.
So, okay. I can picture that. Does he try to come crawling back again at some point?
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, he leaves that night, and I was scared that he was going to come back that night, and I didn't want to call the police, because I didn't want to have someone that I knew from court show up. And I was embarrassed. I had this, they're going to think I'm weak. How could I have had this happen to me? How could I be in a relationship like that? So I didn't call the police. I called a friend from college and asked if I could go over to her apartment. And I did. And then his brother called me that night, and he's like, what's going on? Adam just called me. He's on the train. He's doesn't know what happened. He's drunk. And I said, he hurt me. I said, I can't do this anymore. I'm done. I can't. And then his sisters ended up calling me the next morning, that night into that morning. It bled together. I didn't sleep really at all. They're like, what happened? And they were younger than me, and I felt I didn't want to hurt them. I didn't want to tell them this awful thing that their brother just did. And I cared about them. You know, I was been 3 going on 4 years at that point that we've been in each other's lives, but I was trying to tell them, look, I can't be around anymore. And then he ends up calling me, like, later, and he says he has no recollection.
Oh, he played that card.
Whatsoever. He does not know what happened. He does not remember it.
I blacked out. I don't know. You know, are you okay?
Yep. And I...
Yeah.
I...
Wow.
I went through and I told him everything that happened. And he's like, oh, is that why, like, I have a bruise on my face? Because he said he... And I didn't know. I was like, okay, maybe.
It's possible. Maybe sure, it's possible. Out. I doubt it, but it's possible.
And it was very, you know, I didn't know. And then I was hesitant to tell any of my coworkers, because again, it's like I'm supposed to be in this position of strength and advocating for other people. How could I ever do that if this is what's happening in my personal life? So I did go to the hospital because I had so much pain in my side, and I had he broke my rib.
Sorry. Very sorry.
I think I was in shock that this, you know, I did what I have always done, which was, what just happened? I don't know, but you're okay. You should be okay. You just need to continue on. And that's what I did. I kept going to work. He called. He said he was sorry, said he would never, ever drink again, said he would do anger management classes, all of that stuff. And it was just, I was done. I knew at that point there was no going back ever.
Yeah, if it gets any worse than that, you're dead.
Exactly. And that's something that I didn't know back then. I know now, having done this job for as long as I have, I know now that strangulation is the number one lead indicator for homicide. Women who are strangled are exponentially more likely to be murdered. You know, I didn't know that then. And it's so alarming to me now. But, you know, when I had those thoughts, like I that was absolutely my second thought was, this is how my parents are going to find out I was killed. And it could have happened.
Sure could.
So I eventually did tell two of my good friends that I work with, and I ended up meeting my husband a few months later, and I told him what happened, but I never really processed it. I think I was in, you know, I didn't even say I was in an abusive relationship until recently, because I just, I don't know. I guess I was, it was compartmentalized, kind of.
I know enough about psychology to fill a thimble. This is risky, but I would think that if you keep it on kind of more of a factual level and it doesn't sink to the depths of your ability to feel it, then it can be manageable. It's a defense mechanism. That's pretty much it. And I know that mostly from what happened with my daughter, that if I keep it at a certain level and I don't go into what happened and I don't go too far into what it was like for her, if I don't go delving too far into those things, even though I am aware of them, then I manage it a lot better. And I think that maybe that might be part of your situation, that you know what you need to do. You're almost handling it in some ways like it happened to a friend rather than happening to you. You keep it kind of clinical. And it's pretty much too like the way you've handled your cases. You can hear and you can kind of understand about strangulation. It's a whole different thing to know you can't breathe and you're starting to lose consciousness and you're picturing being dead and the aftermath of your parents getting the word, and in a way, what a stupid way to die. You know, all these things maybe can rush through your mind. Does that sound about right?
100%. I think it was a defense mechanism, absolutely. And it's like a survival thing.
Yes.
Just gonna keep doing what I'm doing, gotta keep trudging along, and you know, I'm not with him anymore, like I'm fine, and just not wanting to acknowledge like that what happened was so terrible. And I've been ashamed for so many years.
Now talk about that a little bit. Ashamed about, I don't want to belabor the obvious, but you know, I want to hear your version of, and I'm not thinking about my curiosity, although it is there, but I'm thinking about people listening to you.
Yeah.
What was your version of embarrassment or shame about this, do you think?
How could I let this happen to me? I'm strong, I'm intelligent, I'm educated, I have family support, I have loved ones, I have things that not everyone has. I go on, get an advanced degree, I'm a lawyer, I'm working in the criminal justice system. You know, how embarrassing. And I mean it genuinely for the better part of a decade, blame myself. You know, and the interesting thing, if you will, I never judged a victim, survivor, witness in my cases. I just didn't. I never said, oh, why is she still with him? Why doesn't she get out? Or what about this? What about that? Like, I never, and I also never minimized things that happened to other people in my cases. But when it was me, it was different. And I don't know where or what that is about, but it just was. And I felt like, such a fraud.
Interesting way to put it. Yeah, it's interesting.
When I was going to court, and I, especially that like couple weeks after that happened, every time we had very heavy wooden chairs in the courtroom, and every time I pulled that chair out, I felt like you're a fraud, because I had this awful, you know, with broken rib, like you feel it, everything you do, breathing, you feel it. And every time I move that chair, I'm just like, you know, you're a fraud. You expect people to come in here and get on that stand and confront their attacker and say what happened to them. And you didn't do that yourself. And I thought, what if he kills someone? And I mean, even I wish I could say that I don't feel this way, but I'd be lying if I didn't say that I do still feel like if he ultimately does do that to someone, won't I have some responsibility in that? Because I didn't call the police. And I recognize, like, I know the reality of it. I know that if I had called the police, they would come. Everyone in my office would know what happened to me. The police department would know what happened to me. I'd have to get on the witness stand, and some defense attorney would be saying, well, how much did you drink that night? And do you really remember this? And what about that? And it'd be out for everyone to see. And what would happen to him? He would likely get a diversion program for first-time offenders, and nothing would happen. But then everyone we went to law school with would know what happened. His family would know what happened, like all this stuff. So I didn't, but I was so terrified that he was going to hurt someone else. And he ultimately did.
Oh, really? Really? I was going to ask you if you Googled his name from time to time to see how our boy Adam's doing, you know, in the aftermath of, so he did, he really did hurt somebody, or, and it came out into the public.
So I didn't, you know,
how'd you find out?
My friend from law school, she found out. It's after the fact, like this is all after the fact.
How long after your relationship with him do you think that this happened?
Maybe it was like 2 years ago that he did it.
Is that 8 years after you and he were done? When would that have happened? After you were out of the picture?
About 10 years or so.
And how bad did that get with that person?
So it was his wife.
Oh, his wife.
He strangled her. And I can only imagine what actually happened in their relationship, or how many times he has done something. And that's...
It led up to that. Did he kill her?
No, thank God.
Okay.
Fortunately, okay. He...
Yes.
But he strangled her to the point where she called the police, and the police came, and he was arrested. And it actually ended up coming out because he ended up getting fired from his job. He lost his job when they found out what happened, and he ended up suing them, which is how it came to light in like the legal community. Because he said he had a drinking problem, or, you know, something like that. And that's why they fired him. And it's like, no, they fired you because you tried to kill your wife in front of your child. But my heart goes out to them. I don't know what their experience was like, but I can only imagine that for it to get so bad that she called the police, that everyone in her community would know what happened. It's just so horrific.
Yes.
It's so horrific.
Yes, it is. The ripple effect of that type of thing is endless, and your imagination can't capture all the places that goes, and the stigma that's attached to the innocent people besides the guy that did it.
And that's exactly it. And I think she was a professional as well. Like she, from what I understand, like she was working, probably rather well-known in her community. And yet we're the ones who have the stigma. And for all these years, the shame I've been carrying around is his shame.
Yes.
But I carry it. And the responsibility for it, acting as though, even if I did call the police and he was arrested the night with me, that would have no effect on what he does 10 years down the road to another person. But I struggled with that for so very long. And I listening to your podcast has really helped me in letting go of that shame and knowing that I'm not alone. It truly does happen to all people from all different walks of life, all different careers, all socioeconomic statuses, races, like geographical locations, everything. And just again, this why? Why are we carrying the shame for something that someone else did to us?
You're this duo and you can't split up the team. This one man, I thought, put it in an interesting way. Let's say that something goes down, whether it's strangulation or some attempted murder situation or even murder. And the guy that did it, let's say, is prosecuted and has to do time. The point that this fellow made, which I never thought of before, was that after that person, guy, whoever it is, does time, they feel like, okay, that's behind me now. I paid my debt and I'm clear, as if the blackboard was erased. In the meantime, the people on the receiving end, people like me that have lost somebody, it never ends. You know, it's there. It's not going anywhere. And then, of course, for the person it happened to, it's endless.
That's, yeah, a very valid point. And I think that also goes to something, you know, we talked about the fact that I didn't process all this stuff after it happened. I just kept going along with my life. And, you know, I had no idea that it was all still back there, that I still blamed myself and was ashamed of all of this. You know, it wasn't until I started doing trauma therapy and really looking at this, being like, to understand that, you know, what happened was extremely significant and it was not my fault. And I don't have anything to be ashamed about. But like you said, here I am, I'm carrying it around and it's 10, 15 years later and I still have to deal with it. You know, another thing, that time dynamic that I want to mention for me is that very first time that happened when we were at law school and I was in the hotel, I didn't know that that was abusive. I didn't know that that was, you know, I knew it wasn't right, but I didn't know that that was abusive. And that's what it was. He was trying to exert his dominance over me and not let me leave, and the control. The other thing is, if someone does something to you in any way, shape, or form, they're going to do it again. And I did not, you know, when these things happened, I was like, well, that happened, but nothing happened for 6 months. So was it really going to happen again? Yes. The answer is always yes. It will happen again and it will escalate and it'll get worse. And there's nothing that solidifies that more for me than the fact that he went and did this to his wife 10 years later. The problem is him. It's not me. It's not his wife. It's him. You know, that's something that for the people listening, I hope that they can appreciate or accept at some point, is this isn't you and this isn't your burden to carry. They're the one who did something wrong and they're the one who should feel that way.
I'm glad you said all of those things, because in the brainwashing style of the people who do this, in the programming that they do, you know, they get good at it. They have been at it probably from the time they were in single digits through their teens on along. You know, so if you come along while they're a teenager or late teens, 20s, they're just very practiced at it. You know, they've played mind games with people for years. It's a practiced art. The other thing that I asked someone years ago who knew this subject much better than I did, is this intentional? I kind of thought it would be, well, no, you know, a lot of these people really don't get what they're doing. What came back was, it's absolutely intentional. They know exactly what they're doing. You know, what happens is that we make excuses for people who do these things, and so we become enablers. We're actually trying to put out a fire with gasoline. You know, we don't realize that type of thing. I like what you said too. I like, meaning I appreciate, not so much like, is that when these things happen, they will happen more frequently and they'll be escalated. So that push one day, I mean, your story is exactly this. I mean, it's the style of the person, and then it becomes somewhat physical, but maybe not so bad. And then we get pushed in the elevator with, we get pushed by the hands, we get kicked and pushed, you know, maybe one day, then we get pile driven into a wall till it breaks. And then we're being strangulated so that if that person doesn't stop or isn't stopped, then we're dead. That's it. Curtains. So, you know, one of the things that I like that some of the survivors have said on this podcast is that we want people who are victims to know that this doesn't have to be your life, that there's another place for you. There really is clear skies and sunlight and happiness for you. You just have to do the work, because typically these things take a while to get going and they're going to take a while to get rid of them. So you have to make that commitment. It has to be you bottom out, you make the commitment, and you're going to do whatever it takes to get out of that. And you have to get out of it safely, of course. And that requires help. And that usually means domestic violence. Agencies are calling the hotline, domestic violence, and the national line, which is 800-799-SAFE, 800-799-SAFE, and do something. Jamie, did you call upon any of these agencies or anything? It sounds like you pretty much, you know, set a course on your own and did what you did.
You know, I didn't. I was always too afraid that I would encounter someone I knew from work. And also that stigma that I felt like people were going to judge me if they knew. So I never did, and made it a lot harder. There, like, I knew there were resources out there, but I didn't seek out that support. And, you know, that's something I would certainly encourage, that there, you know, you're not going to be judged. And there are people that do understand this. And there are people who have gone through similar or the same things. I made it a lot harder on myself than I had to. And that's part of the reason why I wanted to speak to you and why it was important for me to reach out, because I feel like this is the only way that we break down the stigma, is by talking to one another and letting each other know. This happens to anyone from any walk of life. I think that also part of it is you don't know it until you're really in it and you're deep in it. You know, but people make comments like, well, why didn't you leave? Or how could you be in that situation? It's like, I didn't know that's the situation I was in. I could never have imagined in like my worst nightmare that he would have strangled me. Like, that was just never even a thought. So it's, you don't know, you're already then you're invested in this relationship. You care about this other person. You feel sorry for this other person. You think they're struggling with things, or maybe things happen in their life. So you want to be there for them and be supportive, and they, you know, they are sorry. So it's very complicated.
You, on so many of these occasions, did not point at what happened and say, this guy is literally abusing me. Yet you had in your life, in your mind, you know, all your capabilities, you could have made that connection, and you just could never get yourself there until the very end. And I think back to having a ninth grader come up to me after I gave a talk and came up and said that she dated some guy, you know, some version of dating in ninth grade, and she had broken up with him and got out of there, you know, safely and all. But she said to me, I never thought of it as abuse until I heard your talk and you went through all the warning signs of an unhealthy relationship. And she said, I could have checked off every last thing you had, and your list probably had a dozen things. She said, every one of them is like, yeah, that happened to me. Yeah, that happened to me. And, you know, the heading on that slide that I had up on the screen was warning signs of an unhealthy relationship, or let's call it abuse. And she said, I had every one, and yet I didn't get it. And so many people going through it, they just don't get it. They don't get it. And that's okay. And hopefully listening to you, listening to others on this podcast, they start to say, oh my God, that sounds like me, or oh my God, that sounds like my sister, that sounds like my roommate, that sounds like my coworker, that sounds like my cousin.
That's why your work is so incredibly important.
Thank you.
Especially getting into schools and now being a mom myself and thinking about that, like, yes, it is important. It's just with everything else in junior high and high school, that's what we should be teaching our kids so that they understand, that they see it, because that was never mentioned.
No.
And again, like I grew up in a loving, supportive home. I was fortunate that I never witnessed anything like this, but my understanding of what was unhealthy, you know, I thought it had to be that extreme, that, you know, black and white. So I struggled with that, you know, for a very long time.
The stereotype that comes to mind is it happens in some depressed area in a city somewhere, and the woman has a black eye. And I don't understand why she still hangs around this guy who probably comes home, gets drunk, wears a wife beater t-shirt, hits her around, and then they get up and do the same thing tomorrow. And that's just what they do, you know, and it's like, I don't know.
You don't expect to meet your abuser like in your class with you.
Who seems nice 99% of the time.
And for everyone who doesn't know him or who works with him, thinks like, oh, he's an upstanding guy. You know, my parents said that too. I mean, they have like, we had no idea. And it's like, of course, why would you? You saw him a handful of times a year and he was always on his best behavior when you saw him.
Yes.
I didn't tell you about these things because I didn't know what you were going to think, or I did subconsciously know that you were going to not be okay with what I was telling you. So I think that's the other thing too, is you don't know. You can't judge a book by its cover and all those like cliche things you want to say, but you would look at him and be like, oh yeah, he's an upstanding guy.
Anybody's best friend. Thank you so much. And it takes a very special kind of courage to go public with parts of our lives, especially the ones that are so painful and traumatic and things that have happened that we look back and feel ashamed about, embarrassed about. We carry that with us oftentimes. And I want to thank you for putting your concerns for others above your own personal feelings, you know, that you have today, because once the story goes out, it's out. You can't pull it back. This podcast has helped you. I've read in your emails and some of the things you said today. And as you wrote me that one of the things that became very important to you in the last few months is you wanted to take your story and what you've learned and how you feel and pay it forward, because this podcast has helped you and you want to then turn it around and help others. And I can guarantee you that many thousands of people hear this podcast. It's growing pretty rapidly and all around the world. You know, I see the analytics. You know, we're all fortunate about that and being able to get the word out and to take what we've experienced and turn it into good acts and good things and good knowledge, good education for others so that they don't have to go through to the extent that you did. So thank you so much for doing this.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Thanks. Jamie managed to escape the clutches of domestic violence. She was fortunate she didn't die by the hands of the serial abuser she once considered marrying. We thank Jamie for her courageous commitment to wanting her story to help anyone in a dating or domestic violence relationship. She is a hero. Thank you for listening to the When Dating Hurts podcast. We have been steadily moving up in podcast review rankings based on downloads in the relationships category. That means more and more listeners are getting the kind of advice that can improve lives for victims, survivors, and their families. If you feel we need to hear your story, do not hesitate to email me at BillMitchell@WhenDatingHurts.com. That's BillMitchell@WhenDatingHurts.com. Hi, it's Bill Mitchell. I'm proud to say the When Dating Hurts podcast is part of the Evergreen Podcast Network. To learn more about Evergreen Podcasts or to check out other shows on the Evergreen Network, just visit evergreenpodcasts.com.